And 3, 2, 1. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Sheikh, I want to thank you so much for coming to this podcast. I know you are a little tired and maybe even exhausted. I appreciate you coming over.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Of course, always. So I was kind of curious to know a little bit about your background, where you were born and raised. Were you born here or Canada? Where were you born?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I was born in New York, and I was raised in Minnesota.
Oh, you were born in New York? Mm-hmm. I thought you were born and raised in the Bay Area.
No, I came to the Bay Area after I finished high school.
Okay. So after you finished high school, you moved to the Bay Area.
Yep.
And then from what I know, you went to Stanford for your undergrad as well as your grad.
Yeah.
And what did you study there?
Computer science.
Computer science.
Yeah.
Was it a hot field back in the days as well, or is it just something that's hot today?
It was a pretty hot field. That was the dot-com era. Okay. And there was a lot of job opportunities, and there was a lot of students who were studying computer science.
Okay. And this is in the 90s, or?
Yeah, it was in the 90s.
So that was like when the bubble really started growing.
It started expanding at that time. Yeah, it hadn't burst yet, but it was expanding, yeah.
And it burst around 2000, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I went to school with the people who started like Google and yeah.
So you were there when the whole thing was happening,
right.
Basically, in the center of everything.
Well, I wouldn't say I was in the center of it, but I was maybe I could say that, yeah, okay. And if you look at the city as a whole, I was there. Yeah.
How did it feel? Because it's really interesting to, interview someone that was in this super hot field. And we read about it in schools and even history books about tech. So, and it's just really interesting to see a Maulana that went through the tech boom. Mm-hmm. How was it like? And did you ever aspire to create your own startup at one point?
Yeah. There was a lot of excitement, and there was a lot of sense of like entrepreneurship. And there were people who were trying to get startups started. I remember there's a group of us who said, while we were in university, we said, okay, we're going to do a startup. And so we had a few meetings, and there were some pretty talented people in the room. Like I looked up to them and I said, oh, these guys are talented. And you'd think that, okay, well, I was thinking that if we actually can figure out a good idea, then it would make sense. But we never came with a good idea. So it never happened.
Wow. So you actually never got to implementing?
No. But when I did actually start working, I did end up joining a startup.
Okay. And what startup was this?
It was a company that no longer exists. It was bought by another company that was bought by another company. Mm-hmm. But it was in the CRM space.
Okay. Do you have any memories of like meeting anyone that is now famous?
I'm pretty sure that we met the Google founders because there was a research project I was working on where we ended up using like a prototype version of the Google search engine. So I remember like them.
You used the prototype version of Google?
Yeah. Yeah. So
incredible.
Because the project that we worked on, we had to crawl, certain parts of the web. So they had the crawler. And so it wasn't search engine. It was the crawler that gets the pages and puts them into their index.
Interesting. So back in the days, web apps were still like in the infancy. People weren't building websites the way that they build now, right? Like using different frameworks and whatnot.
Yeah, we learned how to build websites using like, we had our Unix account. We would, what was it called? Telnet into the account. And then we would use Emacs to like actually create HTML pages. So we would memorize all the HTML syntax.
Interesting.
Including like even bullet points, we would create them by hand.
So there's like, obviously there's no AWS or any of that back in the days.
Not in those days.
Interesting. And then what I know is that you also started alislam.org.
Yes.
How was that like, starting alislam.org?
So I remember I actually took this class, Introduction to Unix. Mm-hmm. And we had a pretty good teacher, and he taught us like a lot of the things like, how to like grep and then like, I don't know, other types of like, I even forget the names of the commands, but where you could take a file and substitute different things and kind of replace it and all that. So I had gotten these skills, and then there was a book of laws that was published at that time for Ayatollah Sistani. Mm-hmm. And there was an organization that was looking to put that up on the web, and they didn't know how. And then they got a quote from some company. They were going to charge them like £5,000 to do it. And I said that, well, you have a file, like a Word file, and I can do it. It's not a big deal, you know. And so I actually converted it into HTML for them. And I didn't charge them for it.
So it was just a simple Word file?
It was just a simple Word file. And but at okay. that time, it was like this kind of like old mystery. Like, how do you take a Word file and then turn it into HTML? Now it's, of course, you just press a button and it's done.
Wow.
So then it got me thinking that, you know, well, maybe what's out there? Is there anything for Islam and for Shia Islam on the web? And I'd searched. Back in those days, we used to use like Yahoo. They had cataloged different sites, and then there was like Alta Vista. And so we would use
those
that
to
search.
Those are like portals, not really search engines.
Alta Vista was a search engine, actually. Yeah. And I only found one website in the entire web dedicated to Shia Islam. It was actually like a student organization at one of the universities. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, why don't we have like a website dedicated for Shia Islam? And so I used my personal account at Stanford. I created like a subdirectory called Islam, and I named it Islam. That's how what eventually turned into alislam.org was established.
Interesting. And initially you just put a few books.
A few books there. And then there was a few university students who were actively involved with digitizing texts, and at that time they would post them to Usenet use groups.
Ah, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And a lot of people were benefiting from their efforts. May God bless them all. But we were in communication, and so when the site went up, there was some communication about like storing them, using the site as a repository for storing these books. And people were excited because, you know, it was like, oh, we finally have a website. Even though, you know, if you think about it, it was a personal website on a university, but for some reason, you know, people saw it as like a hub. Mm. And so I started collecting the books, and then eventually it dawned upon us, or myself, or I don't remember exactly, to actually register alislam.org as a website. And I went, and at that time there was a certain way of registering, and I saw that nobody had taken it, so I registered.
You just registered the
yeah.
website.
And initially we didn't even, you know, we had both sites, and eventually we moved like the books from here to there, and then there were, at that same time, around, I think it was around 1996-97, we decided to form like a group of brothers and sisters who are going to work together on this effort, and that was the Ahlul Bayt Digital Islamic Library Project.
Did you have your own servers, or did, like, how did you actually host these?
Yeah, we actually had our own physical server, and it was actually based in Minnesota. And we started out with like it's kind of like a small box. Small, relatively speaking. I mean, at those times, all the computers were bigger. Okay, we're not talking about like, you know, the room, they filled the whole room. Okay, but it wasn't like a sure. personal computer. And then as the traffic increased, people were complaining like it's slow. So first we actually had it in the basement of our home. Mm. And then we had like a slower, like a 256 kilobit per second line. And then we upgraded to like a T1 line at home. And eventually then we moved it to like an office building and we got a bigger server. So I remember there was like this big box like type of thing. And eventually then, you know, that sort of era kind of phased out, and then became like the hosted sort of servers. And right, so we, right. you know,
and you just transitioned.
We transitioned. And yeah. It's been many years now that I haven't been actively involved with the project. May God reward all those who are involved. And, you know, they're doing a fantastic job. But that was kind of back in those days.
It sounds like a story of Facebook or Google, right? Like all of a sudden you have this traffic coming and you have to expand to bigger servers. But did you ever imagine that you'll have so much traffic coming in? Or
no.
was it something that just
no.
happened?
No, it just happened. And it was quite amazing, you know, like how I saw many different people like voluntarily just coming together and saying that, you know what, there's a need here. Mm-hmm. If we don't put something together, then it's like this is going to be historical. And we didn't even understand how historical it would be. You know, these days, to get like a higher place on the Google search engine, people might spend like a lot of money, right? There's a, you know, entire like fields of like, you know, data sciences over that are dedicated sure. to like SEO, mm-hmm. right? Search engine optimization. But, you know, the other way of doing it is just you build it early
yeah.
and you kind of, that's where everyone links to. And then, so that's the way it was. Like there was a time where I think you would search for Islam, and then There was a time where I think the first search, first result was alislam.org. Then it was like the second and third, but it was like in the first page. I don't know what it's like these days, but it was quite exciting though.
Were you involved in any other Islamic projects besides alislam.org, or was that, I'm talking about the online projects.
Online. There was also a very interesting discussion group that was established. It was called the Ahlul Bayt Discussion Group. And this was prior to the establishment of al-Islam. There was a respected scholar in the community who, because of his travels for the purposes of giving speeches and teaching and educating and preaching, he had come to know believers in various communities, English speakers, English-speaking believers. And so he said that, well, why don't we link everyone together in a type of email group? Now, just, you know, think about a time, maybe it's hard for you, where there is no Facebook, there's no social media, there's no WhatsApp, nothing. There's just email, right? And where getting an email was like a big deal, you know, and where when you would respond to an email, it'd be more like writing a letter than like just sending like a note, right? It was quite a formal process. And at that time, you know, even spam was like a lot less too. So the idea of being linked to other believers who share things in common, who might even be working on projects that, you know, you can work together, it was novel at that time. And it was so exciting to like meet people through this thing and, you know, different parts of North America, even around the world. And so that was quite an interesting thing. And we would have different discussions and share news. And it was something that I feel personally like it broadened my horizons. I had grown up and I didn't have any type of, my perspective was very local, but this kind of helped to broaden my perspective. And if I think back, I think that this was one of the precursors to alislam.org, because it was through this group that we started to get to know other people, and some people who were kind of into tech. And so we were able to work together then. When it came to alislam.org.
Do you have any ideas for Muslims that want to start Islamic projects online? I know there's a lot of computer science students that are maybe doing an internship, or they're at a university. They're thinking of different projects. And one of the things that they can probably do is create Islamic websites. And hey, it looks really good on the resume as well, right? So that's how I was even able to get my gig, is the employers looked at my resume and they saw projects. And even though they were Islamic projects, they still gave me a shot because it was technical, but at the same time, it was beneficial. And these are like really trivial, small projects that didn't have much impact. But do you have any interesting ideas for Muslims to think about?
I know that there are scholars of the Hausa who are trying to spearhead some efforts for like developing some apps to help people do ahkam related things. Like there is somebody, for example, who's developing an app for inheritance and for khums, and even when it comes to some of the rulings related to women's issues and tahara. And some of these are quite complicated. Now, in the past, some of them have struggled to like find people to do these types of jobs like in a proper way. And even right now, one of the like sort of, for me, like one of the inheritance websites where I actually really trust the people who put it together, the interface is really clunky. So that's one idea that comes to mind, because you want to do something, you want to make sure that it's actually correct. Okay.
Right.
Another thing that comes to mind is there are some problems that we have that that could be solved by the use of technology and by the use of like kind of communication. Like, for example, the exact precise calculation of the Fajr time. Right now, there is like a project, it's called Open Fajr. And if you go and check out their website, it's very interesting how they actually have like this sort of telescope that detects like low light, changes in low light, and is in Birmingham, England. And they're able to like, you know, kind of do some like a proper scientific way of observing when the Fajr sets in using that telescope. Now, that's something that needs to be replicated in other cities. And then we need to collect that data and then come up with, like, you know, the most accurate timetables for Fajr calculation. But that's something that, you know, like that the infrastructure needs to be developed for that, you know, and the awareness needs to be raised that this is something which is important. Other than that, like...
I have an idea. Uh-huh. What about TurboTax, but for Khums?
Yeah, Khums is definitely, it's a huge issue. I think that it's very confusing, you know, then especially these days with so many financial instruments, right?
But why is it confusing? Why can't it be straightforward where we have all the rules laid out to us and we and the marjas make it super clear in their website? Maybe they have a little tool where, you know, we can put in our income, our savings and everything else, just like TurboTax, right? And kind of do all the calculations for us.
Well, that's where that brings up the question of what is the responsibility of the marja and what is the responsibility of those who are, you know, kind of well-wishers and those who would like to help the community. The marjas are doing their job, which is to derive the rulings using the proper tools of ijtihad. And they're presenting those rulings. And if there are some things which are confusing, they have given us a way to be able to send in the questions and get the answers. Now, once the rulings are there, how can they be then, you know, packaged and, you know, an interface be put on them? That becomes the job of those people who have skills in those areas. So definitely, like, by working with, like, a scholar or a group of scholars who can really explain those rules, mm-hmm. If there are people who have a background in finance and technology, they could do something like that. But just take note that they will be taking on a huge responsibility. Because it is something which is complicated, so they want to make sure they don't make any mistakes.
Yeah. All right, so going back to your story, you worked at a startup.
Yeah.
And after working in a startup, did you join a larger company or?
Well, the company went IPO.
Okay.
And so that was an interesting journey. The culture changed in the company after that, and it was more settled. The people who had gotten there early, a lot of them, like, cashed out. Not me. I wasn't there that early. But those guys, like, you know, they bought their Beamers and, like, their nice houses and all that. And then the year 2000 came, and then there was, like, the burst in the bubble.
Yeah.
So we saw this company that had grown very rapidly. I don't think they ever turned a profit, actually. But and then it started to decline. Like, you know, employees started to be laid off. And
that's just incredible how, like, companies had no revenue and they were valued at. An insane amount. Yeah. I don't know how that worked.
But yeah. It was a different time back then. I mean, like, we would go for recruiting events and they would almost pay you to just show up. You know, like, I mean, they would, like, let's say there would be like 15 people at the event. They would be giving away, like, back in those days, there was this, like, these devices called Palm devices.
Oh, yeah. Palm devices. I remember those.
Wait, how old are you? How do you remember that?
I remember when I was like 12 or 10 years old. Oh, some uncle was, like, going around with Palm devices.
Yeah. And so it's interesting. The devices, they never, like, it's not like they weren't, like, connected to, like, some data network or anything.
Yeah.
That you would just use them and then you would charge them and that type of thing. But anyway, it was, they were kind of, like, exciting at that mm-hmm. time. There was no iPads at that time or anything. So they would actually give away those things, like, if you just show up at the event, you know, and, like, there'd be, like, 15 people and then there'd be, like, a draw for them. I mean, it was, like, it was way beyond just free food. Like, you know, that's how much, like, money was being spent.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And all the dream just vanished in the dot when the bubble burst.
Well, I mean, you know, like I said, people who cashed out, they cashed out.
Yeah.
And you know, the people who didn't, they didn't, you know, but I mean, it was, right. Yeah.
Okay. So then what were you doing at that time? Because I know you went to Qom in 2004.
Yeah.
And from the little memory that I have when mm-hmm. I was a kid, mm-hmm. I also remember that you were heavily involved and active at Saba. Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point you were also a principal at Sunday school.
Mm-hmm.
And I got in trouble by you one time, but...
I don't remember that. Are you sure it was me?
You probably forgot.
Sure it was me? Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, like, so I remember you're also super active in the community. You were working at a startup probably, and, like, you were doing all kinds of stuff. Like, what exactly were you doing?
I was just trying to find purpose. You know, you get to a certain point in life when you realize that money, it's just, it's whatever. It's mm-hmm. just something, right? It's a tool, right? It's not an end in of itself. Position, you know, I was a manager, so I had my team. You know, they were reporting to me, and I would do reviews. I would hire, interview, all these type of things. I'd sit in meetings and all that.
You were an engineering manager.
I was an engineering manager.
At the same startup that you just...
Yeah, so then I, you know, eventually got it matured and then I... But that just wasn't, it wasn't cutting it for me. So I remember one day, very particularly, it was like a Thursday. And my wife and I were just, we hadn't really been participating that much in the centers. And we said that, you know what, we're lacking something in our lives. We should really go to the center. And so one time we would come to Sabah, and then one time we would go, and then we found out like randomly at some gathering of like that there's a new center opening up, and it was like the Fatemiya Center in Hayward, and it was actually just a couple miles away from where we were staying. So one day we went there, and you know, everyone was speaking a language that we didn't speak at that time. It was at that time Farsi. At that time I didn't speak it, and so we were like, maybe we shouldn't be here. I mean, because we were like, you know, what are we come here for, right? And then the speaker began to speak in English, and people, he was introduced as like Abu Bakr, but yeah. Abu Bakr, like, may God bless him, right?
He's amazing.
But, yeah, but we weren't sure like what was up, like who he was, and we had understood his name to be something else, and we're like, you know, where is he coming from? But anyway, I was like, that lecture, I remember he gave it. It was about Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, and afterwards, I was thinking to myself that I don't know if I had heard an English lecture with such depth before. It was very deep, you know? Mm-hmm. And then we're like, okay, next Thursday, we're going to go again. And next Thursday, then he talked about some verses of the Quran using primarily Tafsir al-Mizan to explain them. And, you know, I was somebody who, I used to teach Quran in the Sunday school. I used to like reading Quran. I thought that I kind of knew something about the Quran. And when I went to his lecture, I realized I don't know anything about the Quran. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was like profound. And so this was something that was like very much attractive to me. And then I started to realize, this was like one of the things that kind of opened my eyes to something. And then when I went to Sabah, I remember I met, I forget who it was, whether it was your father or, I'm sorry, whether he was there at that time or whether it was, perhaps it was your father, but there was a discussion, okay, that like I was just like, you know, I think I need to do something to help out. Mm-hmm. Because I feel that I just felt this like sort of responsibility. So there was a discussion that was held, and then it was like, well, you know, I could come and like maybe, I don't know, help out with the Thursday program or something, but maybe the best use of my time would be in education.
Sorry, we'll just step back just a little bit. So you talked about how you just weren't satisfied, or like, what were those feelings like? Was it lack of happiness? Was it lack of satisfaction?
Yeah.
Was it just boredom? Like, what exactly were those feelings?
All that and more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, boredom. I mean, I am a tech guy. So it wasn't like I was like, I mean, sure. I enjoyed technology, but there was something lacking.
Okay.
Okay. And I started to see some warning signs too. Mm-hmm. I felt that my heart was dying a slow death. Like spiritual heart.
Was it because you felt like you were too sucked in to the industry, or I don't want to get too personal here, but I know that many people, you know, hearing this might also have this, you know, similar experience.
Yeah.
So could that also be a big factor?
Well, one of the things that I personally would do, this is my personal habit, is that I would work 40 hours a week, and unless there was like a release coming up, I wouldn't really work more than 40 hours a week. Mm-hmm. But what I would try to make sure to do is to make those 40 hours be productive. And I never was asked by my managers to, like, they never sort of faulted me for mm-hmm. not working enough. I did have like a separation between work and life. And back in those days, we didn't have like devices which were connected all the time. We did have like the VPN and all that, but I wouldn't use it unless I really needed to. But I would say that the issue was more about not having a proper like frame of reference, like, and a proper worldview. Like, I didn't understand. My fundamental question was that, what am I here for? Right? Like, I always had this thing in me from when I was young that I need to strive for, like, I want to be the best. Mm-hmm. Right? This is my habit, right? So whether it, like, math, science, or English, I always tried to, like, you know, spelling bee, whatever. I wanted to, like, be the best. And then when I started working, it was like, okay, I can be the best here, but then what, you know? So I was like, something was like a lack of purpose. I didn't understand what I was here for.
Okay. Got it. So then you started, you know, going to the mosque, and then you started going to Sabah.
Yeah.
And then that's when you, like, after hearing the speeches at Fatimiyya, after going to some programs, that's when you really wanted to be involved.
Well, I started to realize that there's more to life than mm-hmm. job. Job is really just, it's meant to be something which is, okay, yeah, you have to support the family, whatever like that. But, you know, there's more to life, right? And I took the approach of like compartmentalization, which is like, okay, I'll put my time in work and then I'll spend some of my free time towards a community service, mm-hmm. which is not the best approach still. Like ideally we have, we're done wahid, that everything is like service of God. But I hadn't been awakened to this other reality that you can actually be doing your job, but it can be also be a service to God. I didn't quite understand that thing. So anyways, when I would be in my job, I would be immersed in that. But then when I would be, I would also dedicate time to the community. Mm-hmm. And what happened is that, like, for example, in these lectures of a brother, Dr. Abu Bakr, he would talk about the stories of like the Urafa, like Allama Tabatabai, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhima. And I realized that, whoa, man, like this is something. Like this is like you can quote all you want, right? You can learn all the quoted languages, you can whatever, but you're not going to get this thing, right? And so that was something that really piqued my interest, that, okay, there's like these realities beyond the material realm. And I felt this like deep yearning to like want to at least understand more about that. Like, you know, what is that? Who is it? How do you get to that type of thing? You know?
You could have learned these things as many people do by just reading a bunch of books. And, you know, you being the founder of alislam.org, you had all the resources to read unlimited books,
yeah.
But yet you decided to go one step further.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, one day randomly, we, you know, threw a goodbye party for you mm-hmm. at Sunday school, and mm-hmm. I found out that you're leaving and you're going to go to Qom.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, what made you think of wrapping up and going to Qom, like leaving Silicon Valley, leaving the tech industry? Yeah. You had a great position as an engineering manager,
mm-hmm.
like you basically had the life, right? Mm-hmm. So you could have just been doing Islamic research and reading books on the side,
mm-hmm.
but you kind of went, like, you know, completely the other way. So what made you decide that?
Yeah, I think that there comes a time in life where you realize that you start to, like, God opens up your eyes to your own deficiencies. You know, ideally, this is something that somebody would always be watchful for, and they would always be monitoring themselves to see where is it that I am lacking.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, maybe, you know, this was a failing on my part. But then something's happened, and God, like, opens up your eyes to these things. So I began to be keenly aware that the lifestyle, this type of lifestyle for me, at least the way that I was approaching it, it was not going to take me to spiritual success for me. I didn't know, and I didn't have a coach that I could turn to.
What was your definition of spiritual success?
Meaning that you're actually getting closer to God.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have like a coach that I could turn to explain my situation and say that, look, what am I doing wrong? But I knew that I could find some help in the center of it all, right? And so we talked about the center, right? So there's a center for this as well, right? And so that's when I said that, okay, let me at least go for a visit there. And so I went for a ziyara visit, and I met with, you know, a number of the students in the Hauza, and I was really impressed. Like, I mean, the stuff that they were talking about isn't stuff that you could find in the English books, right? And it wasn't just that they could quote from books. Like, you know, they had something more than what you can get from just like books. And a number of other things happened. Alhamdulillah, like, I went for Hajj,
mm-hmm.
and Hajj was like a life-changing experience for me. There was a scholar who was visiting Sabah at that time. Sabah at that time was in White Road. And there was one event that I was participating in. And after that event, he came to me. I happened to give like a speech at that event. Okay. And, you know, I shouldn't have been speaking, but at that time there wasn't people to give English speeches. So I had read some books, and then I was presenting for the books. So he told me, he's like, good speech. Your content was a little bit off, but, you know, good try. But then he looked at me and he says, I think you should go to Qom.
Hmm.
And I was like, what? I was like, I quit. I didn't really like, it was the first time I haven't even thought about it before, right? I mean, I thought about it, but it was like, no, I mean, I'm not that type of guy, right? But there's something about the way he said it and the timing, and it was after I went for Hajj, I believe, that same year, and it was like, oh, like maybe I should go for to the Hausa, you know. And then I was like, it was that, like, a number of events that took place. I went for the ziyara, and then it was like, this is what I want. Like I could actually taste a little bit of that sort of spiritual food that I couldn't find in my lifestyle here.
How long were you in Hausa for?
I was there for about 10 and a half years.
10 and a half years. Mm-hmm. And you were in Madrasa Imam Khomeini?
Mostly, yes.
Mostly, okay. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. But a lot of us don't have the luxury or capability, or we'll call it tawfiq, to do what you did, which is, you know, packing up and leaving completely and enjoying the source, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, you've gone through this really, really long journey mm-hmm. to find out the goal of life, what you really want in your life. What exactly have you figured out at this point? Like, what exactly is the goal of life according to Islamic principles? There are other, you know, books out there, philosophical books, they say that the goal of life is just to live happiness. But what is the Islamic perspective of goal of life?
Sure, I can give an answer to that. I mean, I wouldn't want to speak about my own personal you know, I'm not making any claims for myself. I mean, you know, there's one thing to learn about something, another thing to actually achieve it. But there's a hadith which is reported from our Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, where he talks about, like, true happiness. And he says, like, the true happiness lies in a long life in servitude to Allah. Okay, a long life in servitude to Allah. How can I take all the blessings that God has given me and turn that potential into, actualize it, you know, and, like, wherever I've been given, I actually, like, you know, raise the bar and go to the higher level, mm-hmm. and in the meanwhile, like, put it all at the service of the higher ideal and like, service to God, which means, of course, serving the cause of God, right? Serving, meaning, like, ascend spiritually and then help the society ascend as well, right? That's the purpose, you know?
Okay, but that's a little vague because when you say serving God, there's a billion things we can do. Mm-hmm. How do we find that one thing? Is it through going to the community and washing dishes once the program is finished? Is it reciting Quran? Like, what exactly? Mm-hmm. Or is it just wajibat? Like, mm-hmm. can you be more specific mm-hmm. As to what servitude really means?
Well, thank God, you know, we've been given a roadmap, and we've been given guidelines in the form of the Sharia. So coming to know the Sharia is one very important thing that we have to do. And a lot of times, like, you know, even at the basic level of reading, like, being familiar with the Risala of the Marja, that's one step, you know, and then making sure that we understand those things that pertain to us.
So that's the very first step.
That's one of the first steps. Okay. Right? And then there's a lot of responsibilities and rights and even laws that sometimes aren't mentioned in those books, and we have to go to other sources to get them. For example, you know, when we talk about, like, the rights of different people on other people, different groups of people, like teachers and neighbors and parents and, you know, siblings and family members and Surat al-Rahim and all these things, some of them are, it goes beyond what's mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then there's specific sort of parts of the Sharia that have to do with, that govern certain parts of our life. For example, when somebody wants to earn a living, when somebody wants to have a family, when somebody has kids, right, there are, like, Islamic principles and guidelines that we need to be acquainted with, right? So one important step is just becoming acquainted with these guidelines and these principles. And that's why there's so much emphasis on seeking knowledge. Even if somebody's not a like a scholar of the religion, but still the Ahlul Bayt have told us that our expectation is that you do tafaqqah in the deen. But that type of tafaqqah, or getting deep knowledge, has to do with being familiar with those things that I practically need to be aware of.
Such as?
Such as those things that I mentioned, like all aspects of my life, like what is Sharia say? But that's that level of like what to do and what not to do. But even in terms of then understanding, well, overall, like what is it that I've been created for? What is it that society is meant to attain? What did the Prophet and the Imam strive to establish in the society? Like what did they want to do? Like what kind of, you know, like these days, you know, we kind of assume that there's these things that are taught to us that, okay, the best society is the one which is a democratic society, it's a capitalist society, it's a free society, it's an open society, it's a whatever, all these things. Or now these days they're saying that, no, it's not open, it should be something which is selective, it should be for like this race. I mean, there's all these different like ideologies that are thrown out there. What is the Islamic ideology? Mm-hmm. So this type of education, it's something that all of us would want to, you know, understand. Not, there's different depths, right? The one time when you go at the source and you actually derive it, and from the, that's what the Hawza is for. But at least at the level of like being literate, being a well-versed person when it comes to Islamic ideology and Islamic worldview and Islamic practice.
How can people do that if they don't have if they can't go to Qom?
Well, connecting with scholars. That's with trained and scholars who practice what they preach. One of the senior scholars who's from the West. Recently I was attending one of his lectures and he made this comment. He said that in my experience, those who would like to be keep the connection to their faith alive, it's important for them to have like a regular session with a qualified alim at least once a week. Mm-hmm. Okay, no matter what you're doing, you could be a lawyer, you could be a dentist, you could be a construction worker, whatever, right? But having that connection with the teacher. Mm-hmm. And in my own personal experience, when I was in Qom, like the best time, heaven on earth is when you sit at the feet of your teacher, and you learn from them. Right? There is nothing. I don't know if there's other higher forms of pleasure, but this is something. I mean, of course, when somebody, becomes acquainted with the true teachers, right? And that's even more. But I'm just saying that it's something which is very beautiful, right? So that tradition needs to be there. And then there's a whole discussion, well, what if you don't have access to the scholar? Well, that's a different topic. If you don't, like, let's say that somebody, if you can't do that for whatever reason, we do have some online resources now, some websites that are run by, trained and certified, authorized scholars. And they offer like different programs, where you can kind of go at your own pace, which is an option, not obviously a replacement for the other type of thing, but it's something.
Yeah. So being acquainted with the sheikhs, being well versed in Sharia, understanding the fiqh and maybe usul,
the ideology, the ethics.
So these are basically the grounds for us to kind of reach the level of basically going in the path of our goal of life.
Well, that's all knowledge. Yeah. Right. Now we have to act on that knowledge.
Okay. So, right. So once you acquire you can never acquire the knowledge, but let's just say that, someone has the basics down, right? Mm-hmm. They do their wajibat, they avoid the muharramat. Mm-hmm. But they still feel like they're very far from what they can, achieve spiritually, mm-hmm. especially people that are working in the industry. So an example would be like, let's say that they're in a big tech company, mm-hmm. Or even any company for that matter, there's so much haram that goes on, right? You see people drinking alcohol, people are doing weird things in all hand meetings, there's interactions with non-mahram, and there's like constant people are constantly swearing. Even the boss nowadays, everybody basically swears. Obviously, you can't pull away from work altogether, or you can't really provide for your family. And not everybody can just wrap up and go to Hawza. So you're telling me that, okay, do all these things, but at the end of the day, like what really matters is preserving ourselves when it comes to workforce or school or whatever. So do you have any tips to protect ourselves from from shaitan at the workforce or at school or anywhere else?
Well, one point I want to emphasize is that obviously we want to be engaging with the larger society. We don't want to be isolationists. But we also want to maintain our identity and be proud of it. And we want to be able to establish those type of institutions where we kind of present our own value system and our own agenda. So, for example, like what we need to be doing is ideally like those who are skilled, those who have talent, come together and establish your own businesses, right? Where you can set the pace for like the environment and you can set the conduct and these things. And it can be a great source of education, you know, that, okay, well, this is how the Muslims do it. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, there's so many Muslims in this area that in the major companies, like all their cafeterias serve halal food. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
So, I mean, so the potential is there. I'm not saying that it has to be exclusive, mm-hmm. but at least the value system, you know, the way it's designed can be based on and can incorporate Islamic culture and Islamic values. And then when you work together, then you say that, okay, well, this is the way we do things. When we go and see clients, we have a company policy, for example, where we don't shake hands. Mm-hmm. Okay, no, it's not no hard feelings. When it's a company policy, then nobody's going to feel bad about it, right? That's just the way we do things, right? And we have a company policy of we don't have alcohol, right? So that's just how we do things. Now, let's say somebody is not in that position. I'm just talking about ideal. Then one thing is constant vigilance of the self, you know, being watchful over oneself, what one sees, what one says, what we do, right? That vigilance is one of the most underutilized but most effective ways of maintaining our status as Allah's slave and servant. Because after all, you know, when we're not monitoring ourselves, we don't have that watchfulness, we don't have that self-awareness, then what's going to happen is that we'll be overpowered by our base desires. And, you know, we say that we're committed to like staying away from haram and doing the wajibat, but what might happen is we're not even realizing what's happening, what we might be saying, what we might be actively listening to, what we might be even seeing. So this active awareness of oneself, active vigilance, which is called muraqabah, and muhasabah, taking account of one's actions. And then making sure that we take time for ourselves, right? We have to realize that when we're in these environments where there is sinfulness, we are going to, you know, be affected by it unless we take active measures to shield ourselves from it. Those active measures would include being very committed to the wajibat. You know, and we're told in hadith that the benefit of reciting prayers on time versus after that time, not even qada, is the benefit of the akhirah over the dunya. Mm. Right? So why would somebody want to delay that? Right? It's like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, right? Why would you want to delay it? Right? There's provisions there. You can go and pray, say your prayers. And making sure that we compensate for this by having an active spiritual routine that we pursue on a regular basis. Reading Quran, you know, like giving charity, being familiar with the du'as of the Ahlul Bayt, the munajat of the Ahlul Bayt, ziyarat, right? These are things which can, like, even if it's a small thing, but we do it regularly, it can have a huge impact. Making sure that our income is halal, right? Like, why should we jeopardize our akhirah just for the sake of a few extra dollars, right? Like, Allah will provide rizq to us, right? We don't need to, we can be selective and choose only those things where we're not forced to support haram or do haram things. And then making sure that we're being balanced and performing our overall duties to ourselves, our families, and the society at large. Somebody who is just focused on themselves in the prime years of their lives and they're depriving the community of their presence and their service, well, I mean, this is, people need them, right? I mean, you have talents, use them in the way of God by helping your fellow people. There's so much work that needs to be done. There's so much infrastructure that needs to be built in our communities. Come and use your talents, you know? Even at the level of like family, a lot of times like people just get so involved with their careers, they neglect their children, they neglect their spouses. And it's more like the home is more like a convenience place for people to just like a rest stop, you know. But the real life is like, you know, in the workplace. That's what the companies want you to think, that that's where your life is. But we shouldn't see work that way.
What would you say to people that want to contribute their effort and talent in the community, but they feel like it's not, because it's not, you know, professional, things are chaotic, and things aren't as organized as they intend to be, and there's politics, there's always politics involved. Many folks that I personally know kind of just get turned off by that, and they're like, you know, it's just not worth it.
Yeah.
What would you say to them?
I would say that, you know, politics is part of life. I mean, that's just the way things work, right? And you'll have different conflicting opinions on things and disappointments and here and there. But, you know, it's there's no option here. I mean, what are we going to do, right? I mean, we have to do something, right? And so I would say that you have to have patience, right? We have to expect that when we try to do good things, Shaitan's going to come and try to, you know, kind of convince us not to and bring a lot of excuses for us to just leave it behind. But if we do it with sincere intentions, we have to realize that our effort itself is what counts. The results are in the hands of God. Also, like, we have to be willing to accept leadership. There's one problem that we have. Sometimes we think that, okay, I'm an expert in, like, you know, tech or whatever, right? So that means that I'm an expert even when it comes to community development. No, like, it's a different field, right? So we have to recognize where expertise lies. We have to be able to work together. We have to be willing to even sometimes learn some new areas just so we can help out, right? Or if we can't, then we fund those who will go and learn those areas so that we can have like the proper knowledge and expertise in order to do things. You know, for example, one of the areas which is so important these days is Islamic schools, mm-hmm. right? Like real Islamic schools, not just like Muslim schools, but Islamic schools. So that's something which, you know, we need people to have that expertise and to be able to guide and manage these type of projects.
All right. So you mentioned Islamic schools, and I really wanted to talk about that before we conclude. But why do we even need Islamic schools? One of the common questions that a lot of people have, especially like parents that send their kids to private school, is that, you know, they're thinking like, well, if I send my kids to a really good private school, it's going to have like all of the good environment and everything else. And I can even teach my kids Quran at home. So why do I even need to send my kids to Islamic schools where they might pick up an accent that I don't want them to pick up, or they might not have as high quality of education and so on. So, like, you know, so what would you say to those parents?
That's a great question. And it's something actually that requires like a bit of time to answer. And it's something I'm quite passionate about. But I know that our time's limited. I have a commitment as well that I need to get to. So I'll just give a brief answer at this sure. point, and maybe some other time we could pick up on that.
Yeah, maybe we can have a whole podcast just on education.
Inshallah, if Allah gives us tawfiq. So I would just say that, you know, first of all, we have to understand what is the purpose of raising a child. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you after, right? Is it that you just want them to have a good place in the dunya? Or that, okay, they're going to have a comfortable, inshallah, life. They're going to be like not needy and dependent on others. They're going to be people who can stand on their own feet and who are articulate and who are like, let's say, intelligent, whatever. But that's something which has to do with just this dunya. And there's a whole other realm there, which is the akhirah, which is actually the ultimate destination. That's what we have to raise our children for, to be successful in the akhirah. Now, we have to have a wider perspective that, you know, life doesn't end when we go down into the graves, right? Life continues. But it's the dunya which is the place where we sow the seeds that will then bear fruit in the akhirah. Now, how do we do that type of raising of our children, right? I mean, when do we do it? Like, it has to be done when they're young, right? And the type of the work that needs to be done is quite a lot, right? Like, there are a lot of things that need to be learned. Like, these things that we're talking about, ideally they would be taught, you know, when somebody's young. Learning them after you start your job is super difficult. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of knowledge that needs to be learned. There's a lot of customs, a lot of culture. So we need an environment to do that. And the most natural environment is the school. That's what schools are for. It's for teaching. Not only that, just think about this, you know, like, when you go throughout the day and the name of God is not mentioned, that is not called religious freedom. that's called the promotion of a quote-unquote religion, which is the absence of God. Mm. It's a worldview. It's a secular worldview. Now, do you want to be responsible for teaching your children the religion of secularism for 5 days of the week, and then you want to try to make up for it like in a, you know, kind of a typically, you know, less organized, unprofessional manner on a day when your children really want to be at home chilling, right? I mean, that's it's a difficult thing for parents to like accept, right? It's a very serious thing to think about. The presence of, when you don't mention God, that itself is a worldview. Not only that, there's a lot of risk involved when it comes to like being exposed to ideologies, when it comes to being exposed to role models, because teachers are role models who actually follow, they have different set of values. And there's a lot of risk involved with even like things like drugs and bullying and so many other things, right, that are there. And sometimes we see children who, you know, their parents really tried hard, but then they get to a certain age and then they're gone, right? Now, are all Islamic schools the solution? No, it has to be done right. Mm. And it has to really be Islamic. And there's a lot we could talk about that. But I haven't seen any institution which has more potential in terms of being able to like help parents perform their responsibility than a good Islamic school. And I've seen a lot of success stories and just like where you have the right environment, you have the right people, you have the right approach, it can really help a child to develop and flourish in a holistic manner. And when they come out of the school, they're ready to like be leaders in the society. And they're going to set the trend. You know, they're going to be excelling, and they're going to beat others at their own game, and then they're going to be leaders in terms of morality and ethics and values, and having like a strong purpose in life.
Well, Sheikh, we're actually running out of time. I wanted to cover a lot more topics, but
I talk a lot.
No, it was like very, very interesting. Ideally, we would have a 2-hour podcast, but we'll definitely have you back here and talk about other interesting topics that many people requested us to talk about. Thank you so much for coming. But before we wrap up, I have a really quick question to ask you. And that is, if you were to have two different words, and you can, you know, put these two words in a billboard anywhere in the world, maybe Times Square. What would those two words be?
And what's the purpose of the words?
Anything that you want. So someone gives you power to put two words, two big bold words anywhere in the world where a lot of people will see. Mm. What would those two words read?
That's a really good question. I wish you had given me that question from before. Maybe something about something to do with some type of, oh man, this is a difficult question.
Be good.
No, that wouldn't be. So I would say something about like with which would activate like somebody to do some introspection, self-introspection, because, okay, you know, within, you know, like the saying of Imam Alayhi Salaam, like his, like that, don't imagine yourself to be like just a contained small body, but within you is like the whole universe. It's there. Mm. It's contained within you. So realize your, maybe I would say something like that, like three words: realize your potential.
Realize your potential.
Yeah.
Okay. Realize potential. Can we just do that?
It might sound a little bit desi. If you wanted to, you could put it that way.
Perfect. Well, realize your potential. That's a really great way of ending it. Again, thank you very much, Sheikh Salim.
You're welcome.
Inshallah, you have a wonderful rest of the stay here in Bay Area, inshallah.
Inshallah. Thank you so much for all your efforts. May Allah reward you.
Inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.